the only CFRC 101.9 FM.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about a graduate research here at Queen's and at some other Ontario universities. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Debbie Hernandez, who is doing a PhD in English and Film Studies at Wilfrid Laurier University under the supervision of Dr. Eleanor Tai. Welcome to Grad Chat, Debbie.
Thank you for having me, Colette.
And, you know, if people are probably wondering, why have I got a student from Wilfrid Laurier on our show? Well, as normally happens around this time of year, through summer, we have different writing camps. And one of those, as you know, is called the Lake Shift, where we invite other Ontario PhD students to come and join us at Queen's University Biology Station for 1 week of a writing retreat called the Lake Shift. And that's where I get an opportunity to meet a lot of fabulous doctoral students from across disciplines and, of course, across universities. And usually from that, I can get at least two or three of them to put their hand up to come on Grad Chat. And it's nice to hear what other Ontario universities are doing with their particular programs, because we don't all have the same programs. So it's nice to see that. And I know this past Lake Shift, we had, Wilfrid Laurier was there, of course, and they're a big supporter of our writing retreat. We had Waterloo, we had Brock, we had Toronto Metropolitan, we had Carleton, we had Nipissing and Lakehead, and York. I'm not sure if I missed anyone there, and of course, our Queen's students. So Debbie was one of those who very kindly put her hand up, or I'm not sure she was quite volunteered, but clearly got lots to tell us. And so thank you very much for coming on the show, Debbie. And anyway, we should get on to your research, because that's the whole point of me asking you to come on the show. And so, as I mentioned, Debbie is in English and Film Studies, but her research topic, demythologizing our stories, reconnecting with cultural teachings in the Filipino diaspora. So, first of all, before you give us a bit of an overview, why that topic? Of all the topics you could pick from English and film, why that particular topic? What's in it for you? What brought you to do that?
Thanks, Colette. So this topic was one that I accidentally came upon during my master's when I was taking an archive studies course. So I had a really good professor, Dr. Nadine Atwell, who's now at Simon Fraser University. And that course was about kind of critically examining what it means to research in the archive and what is considered and held within the archive. And so one of the projects I was interested in looking into was these stories of these supernatural beings that I grew up learning about from my paternal grandmother and my caretakers. And what's interesting to me is I never thought of these sort of supernatural beings and supernatural teachings as just stories. Like, I genuinely believe in them, and so did my grandmother and my nannies, essentially. So I wanted to just learn more about them and see what the archive would have to say about it. And by archive, I mean the ones that are considered valid in academia, which is, research databases, journal articles, books, films. So at the time that I was trying to do that preliminary research for this final project for that course, I found very little that I could use. A lot of the articles and the texts that I could find were written in like the 80s or even earlier, during pretty much the early 20th century, when the Philippines was a colony of America.
Right.
Of the U.S. And they were all written by, you know, white Americans or Spanish missionaries. Just none of the research that I was looking for, which is written by, you know, Filipino or Filipino-American scholars doing this work and analyzing these cultural practices and cultural teachings from the perspective of somebody who is from this culture, rather than an outsider kind of examining it and othering it as like not real and not valid. And so I was taken aback, because I know for a fact that a lot of other cultural teachings, for example, within Canada and even in other countries, like South Asian cultural teachings or Indigenous cultural teachings within Canada or other parts of the world, there is a lot more articles and a lot more formal research done on, let's say, the so-called myths or stories from these different cultures and ethnic backgrounds. But there was very, and those were done by people within the, but for my culture or my country, for Philippines and the Filipino diaspora, there was very few articles and books that I could, you know, immediately find at that time that were written by people from within the community. They were always by researchers from outside the community. So I saw that there was basically a gap. There's a gap, and I wanted to look more into that. And I felt that if I pursued this, it would be a good thing for other, you know, future scholars, Filipino and Filipino-Canadian, Filipino-American, junior scholars and researchers who want to learn more about this topic from somebody who actually grew up with it and believes in it and treats it as valid, rather than, you know, and yet another researcher from outside the community that just sees it as like a myth, something that isn't real.
It's interesting when you express what archives meant. It's again, it's something that academia has determined is worthy of being in there, whether that's true or not. And then you're talking about myths that have come through certain cultures. So is that indigenous knowledge, indigenous or cultural knowledge that we should be asking the people who had that, again, as opposed to us making assumptions of what's worthy to talk about and what's not? So do you see this more of looking into the cultural background, and then are you wanting to sort of preserve the cultural knowledge within your own community, or make people outside that community understand why you have this mythology?
I think for me, more so, it's understanding it for myself, because I know that within my own family, there are people who don't believe in these things, and then there are obviously people that are, and those were the people who taught these stories to me. So I was just really curious and interested about why there's such a, well, I mean, I understand why there's a discrepancy. Obviously, like, not every community is homogenous, not everyone is going to believe in the same things. But I wanted to know and look into what are the factors that affect, reasons for why somebody in the Filipino or the Filipino diaspora would or would not believe in these stories and these
right.
beings and these teachings. Because it's not like it's viewed as a religion where, you know, oh, this is a valid religion, but I mean, I don't personally believe in it. It's more like there's this sort of visceral reaction, especially from people within the community and within even within my own family, of that some of these teachings and stories and beliefs are silly. They're not modern. They're not real. They're very primitive. They're only people who are uneducated or whatever that would believe in these things. So there's like a value added judgment, not only to belief in these teachings themselves, but also in the people who would or would not believe and practice certain aspects of, I guess, what you would call Filipino cultural belief systems, for the reason that Christianity or Catholicism is seen as a valid form of, like, belief and religion. Even if you think about it, there are elements of it that would be considered magic or supernatural, but it's not given that label. It's because it's very mainstream and it's a normalized form of belief.
So what are these supernatural beings and mythology that is going around, and who's, you said, you know, there's some people talk about it and something, so who is talking about it, who is believing it, and what does that mean when they believe in it?
Thank you for asking that. So there's a, one of the major figures that I recently finished writing about in my research, and one that I would say almost all Filipinos that you ask would be at least familiar with it, if not know exactly what this is this supernatural being called the Aswang. The closest thing I could compare it to would be like a vampire in Western culture and stories, but there's equivalences of it in other cultures. So in Malay cultures, there's a similar figure called the Pontianak. And I think in Scotland, there's a Banshee. Mm-hmm. So it's a female or feminized supernatural being that's seen as monstrous. It preys on different victims depending on who you ask, because this, the Aswang, is regionally specific as well. It has different names, but it's an umbrella term for these sort of malevolent creatures or beings that have supernatural powers. Some people say that it preys on children. Some people say that it preys on, or she preys on, corpses. Some people say that she preys on, like, the fetuses of pregnant women. So it really depends on who you ask and which type of Aswang and from which region.
Sounds like the Big Bad Wolf.
Yeah, but it is a very fear-inspiring creature, and the story of the Aswang is often told to children as sort of like a way to get them to behave. If you don't do X, Y, Z, yeah, then you will, it will come after you, you know. But the more I looked into it, I saw that there was like a soup, like there was a lot more about the history of the Aswang than what I was told as a child. So that's one of the major ones that I was looking at, but there's also other figures as well.
Is this Aswang, I mean, I know you said basically what it could do, but it was it also like revered in a way of, if we keep the Aswang happy, things will be better?
No. So there's always this element of, we want to like eliminate it at all costs, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like the vampire in that way, where, you know, the best thing to do would be to like get like kill it or eradicate it. It's seen as like terrorizing communities, and it can like, she can live as a, or pass as a regular person by day, and then by night she becomes this like monster that preys on innocent people.
So with this though, and you said it was, I found it interesting, you said like depending on the community it could be called something different or has slightly different myth to it. What are the people, when they talk about it, the believers, are they just wanting to believe in the fact that there is something like this out there, or there's something out there because of a reason, and therefore as a community we need to be doing this, this, and this to prevent it coming to our community?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question, and the articles that I've, or the research that I've done, has had differing views on it. Some research, like Herminia Menyes, who is like a Filipino a folklore scholar, has said that the aswang was actually something that originates from the Spanish colonial period as a way to sort of demonize female healers and community leaders. To sort of strip them of their power, they would disseminate these beliefs that they're actually, you know, malevolent spirits in disguise or evil beings. Because prior to the Spanish colonial period, women had a lot more agency. They didn't live under a patriarchy. And they were seen as equals to, let's say, the male, like, warriors in, like, a community. The women were called babaylan, and so they were seen as having, they had respect, they were seen as having unique supernatural powers, and they were seen as leaders of their community. And so one way Spanish missionaries and colonial administrators would try to kind of take away that power and would be to demonize them and have people who they were converting to Catholicism think that, you know, these powerful women are actually in communion with the devil, and so we need to get rid of them. So that's one theory.
Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of like Salem witch hunt and things like that. Anyone who's a healer must be something extraordinary there that's happening, some devil thing working.
Right. So like people who, like women who were single or who didn't have a family and who were, you know, not doing the traditional thing, gender roles that women were expected to have within a patriarchy were seen as, you know, they must be, and a lot of them were like doing traditional medicine and people were turning to them for advice and wisdom as well. Those women were seen as like, oh, there's something wrong with them. I think, you know, at night they're an aswang. So that's one theory of why these beliefs in the aswang came to be. But beyond that, I don't know. I guess people believe in something because it was real and it was passed down to them. And it could also be like an in-group, out-group thing. You know, there's a lot of Filipino horror movies that are about the aswang, and some really great film critics have analyzed, film study scholars have analyzed them to kind of draw out the meanings of why this figure is being used. But as for why people would believe in the aswang, I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess it's just like it's seen as a supernatural being that's native to the country, to that region. So,
good point that you said there in terms of that particular region. I'm assuming across the whole of the Philippines, there's pockets that are more in belief as opposed to other pockets that may be more of the cities that maybe aren't. Have you found that in some of the archival or findings as you're going through this?
So from what I'm finding, people from rural regions would maybe more likely to have beliefs in supernatural beings, and people who are not necessarily just because they live in a city, but maybe people with a higher socioeconomic status and went through formal education would perhaps have like a less of a likelihood to believe in, you know, supernatural phenomena as legitimate in general. And I don't think it's because, you know, only uneducated people believe in these things, but it's more like formal education is like the university in the Philippines, and public education was established by Americans during the colonial period. So obviously it would uphold American cultural values, some of including ones that would say these teachings are pre-modern and primitive and don't belong in like a progressive, modern, secular society. So people who would be going to school, you know, that's kind of the framing that
they're getting one point of view. Yes,
right,
which we've seen across a lot of countries who have been colonized. So you talked about in the beginning, you started looking through sort of archival records and things, but you found that was very one-sided. So with your research itself, are you actually having the opportunity to speak to Filipino believers and non-believers? Are you having the opportunity to do that? And then if that's the case, how are you bringing that together for your own work?
So one of my proposed chapters was just to talk to my family.
Right.
Because obviously, like, my grandmother believed in these things, but then my dad doesn't. But that chapter is a little bit different now because my grandparents passed away a few years ago.
Right. So it's hard to get that information, yes.
Right. And so, you know, obviously that in itself could be something of looking into. Like, you could see these as, like, you know, these archives. People are archives carriers of these stories, and if that generation is not coming to Canada or passing away, what happens then to these stories in the diaspora? So that was one. That is one question that I'm interested in looking at.
Well, particularly too, from one generation to the next, what made it change?
Exactly. So that is one chapter that I'm interested in looking at, but I feel a bit intimidated. Because my training, I guess, my academic training is in literary analysis, kind of looking at how these teachings and stories are being reanimated in diasporic film and fiction. So I haven't had a chance to tackle that chapter yet where I would be talking to my family members.
I think it's interesting you said that because, I mean, literature doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't have to be in the written form. Or in the film form, you know.
Right.
Literature is from storytelling, and storytelling was oral. But we all get stuck in that, right, don't we? Like,
right.
It's not, it's on paper, it can't be true.
Exactly,
or how much
exactly.
do we... Yeah.
And if all my essays and years of going to school has always been training on how to write about written text, it can feel really intimidating and... you know, scary to write about oral histories or other cultural, like, other texts. So that is something that I'm grappling with because I know it's important work. And many of the world's cultures have stored their stories in oral histories for forever. So it wouldn't be fair to ignore these as not a valid form, not a valid text. So, and I know it has been done, so I just need to do the work. But for now, I haven't, you know, tackled that chapter yet.
So with your background, you know, you've written here in some of the information you gave me, you say, you know, you got ideas from feminist theory and post-colonial studies. How is that helping you with this particular project?
Thanks for asking that. So I actually, like, I hesitate to call these stories and teachings indigenous because I know that word is associated with, like, specific indigenous groups in or specific indigenous nations in, you know, Canada or Turtle Island, Australia. There are even indigenous groups within the Philippines, indigenous peoples in the Philippines who have their own stories and teachings. So, but my framework for looking at, you know, stories and stories that are absent from the colonial archive comes from feminist and indigenous and black and post-colonial scholars looking at how peoples and ways of being and ways of knowing are further marginalized because of this connection between power and knowledge production.
Right.
So only one way of gaining knowledge and storing knowledge and learning about things is seen as valid, then what is being left out, what is being marginalized, what and how can we read those and be attuned to those silences and absences?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like reading against the grain. And I wouldn't have, you know, the way I see things before, if something isn't there, then we have nothing. There's nothing to look at. We can't find anything. So I guess
it's
not there. But then I've read really great scholars, black, indigenous, feminist, postcolonial scholars who say that there are other ways of thinking about and theorizing those absences and silences. So that was kind of where I was coming from when I looked at this project.
And what are you hoping to accomplish? Because at the end of the day, we've understood why you've come into this in terms of wanting to learn a little bit more outside of what's commonly shown in archives. So, you know, what is actually going on? What are you hoping that your project, your research can show to all of us?
I think that's a great question. So I'm hoping that it'll show to us the same thing that it showed to me, which is that even if the stories that I was raised learning about and knowing, and the people like me or other marginalized people who are missing from academia and colonial archives, academic archives, institutional archives, we might be missing from, you know, these dominant knowledge systems, these are not the only valid ways of knowing. And it doesn't mean that our stories don't exist. It doesn't mean that our histories don't exist. It just means that we have to find more creative modes of inquiry and different ways of thinking about things that challenge those dominant systems and draw people's attention to these systems of power, systems of oppression, and these power dynamics and how they're inextricably intertwined with knowledge production. And it's applicable to people from other cultures too, who might find their stories missing from, you know, novel films, archives. It just shows that, you know, there was a reason why their stories were excluded, oftentimes for political reasons, and it's for a way of maintaining power. That invalidation is not an accident. It's often on purpose, which is what a lot of post-colonial theorists and scholars have mentioned. That form of othering, of delegitimizing these stories, is very much a strategy of maintaining power. So to read against these systems, rather than seeing the absences as there's nothing there to be studied, but rather something as like a productive space that we can look at and read and think through, I think has been really helpful for me when researching and thinking about my own upbringing. And so I would hope that other people too, who might find themselves and their communities excluded from mainstream narratives, would be able to apply those thoughts as well.
Those thoughts. And so I think this is fascinating, and I'm really pleased that you're enjoying doing it, because it's not only, you're not only just getting your PhD, going towards your PhD, but you're also finding out a little bit more about yourself along the way, which is basically learning. It should be all about that anyway, is, you know, what can we learn for ourselves as well as other things. It's like, good on you for doing that.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best with it. I'm sure that chapter that you talked about, that'll come together. No problem.
Thank you very much.
So, Debbie, unfortunately, we're going to have to call it quits, but I do appreciate you coming on the show and taking the time. And I'm sure everyone got a good idea of not just the work, but just rethink how we see things. And if nothing else, that's really important, because it's very easy to get fixed on one track and forget about anything else that's going on around us. So thank you for showing that to us. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. On Saturday, September 7th, the Queens Gaels will host the York Lions at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Last year, Queens walked into York Stadium and left with a resounding, historic victory. but this is not the same program we saw 1 year ago. A new era is dawning at York University. A new coach, new players, and new culture has restored the roar. A team that once fought just to survive is once again playing with pride. Now the Lions will look to even the score. Can York record their first ever victory against the Gaels? Or will Queens continue their royal rule over the Lions? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM or CFRC.ca to catch all the bone-crunching action. 2:45 pregame show, 3 p.m. kickoff. We hope to see you there.
Cego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. An Anzeni Shukwithan.
Tante.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
I, Inukhatikai, I'm Madeline Alakarellak, your host for Words and Culture on our Inuktitut language. I am so sad to say that this is our last episode because it has been an absolute treat to be able to talk to amazing Inuit who are working hard in their own ways to keep our Inuit culture and language alive. I have also had the honor to listen to beautiful Indigenous languages in these series because as a people, we were colonized for so very long. But still, we have these amazing traditions that have continued because of the people like all of our guests. So though it's my last episode, I'm so happy that you were able to hear our Ojauseat. Friends is the voice of Beatrice Deer. She's an Inuk Mohawk singer-songwriter who grew up in Qaqtaq Nunavik. Beatrice is also a seamstress, a podcast host, a mother. She's Jane of all trades, that one. Beatrice uses sobriety and healthy living as her means of leading by example. You could see her TikTok videos. They show us how she exercises every day. But it's through music that she and I met. That's years ago now. Fast forward, the day Beatrice came to visit my house in Montreal recently was a very busy day. It's really not uncommon for Inuit to just show up at your door. It was a very special visit this time in my house. Her panik or her daughter, Aksangnak, also joined us. Aksangnak is a young traditional contemporary Inuk tattoo artist who is traveling all over Inuit Nunangat and blessing all kinds of us Inuit women with these markings. It's a revitalization of a part of our Inuit culture that was almost completely lost. So, coming up on Words and Culture later on, Aksangnak Deer will be adding to my traditional chin tattoos. But first, here I ask Beatrice, her mom, Anananga, what she thought about her daughter's pursuit.
Yeah, I'm so proud of my daughter, Aksangnak. Yeah, it took me by surprise at how strong she came to becoming this artist.
Describe what she's done to your face.
She has made me a chin line and cheek dots.
That's amazing.
Yes.
For our listeners that don't understand what these markings mean, what do they mean for you?
For me, it means taking back our identity. These traditional tattoo practices were stolen from us. When the missionaries started coming to our lands, they forbid anyone from practicing this ancient tradition. They abused their power. They told everyone that you will go to hell if you have tattoos. And of course, Inuit being obedient and naive, fearfully obeyed this false doctrine. Mm-hmm. So for 100 years, Inuit stopped tattooing. I've never seen anyone with facial tattoos. I've seen many women with dots on their wrists that were an attempt at traditional tattooing.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So,
they too had heard about it, but not
yes.
witnessed any Inuit women with them?
Yes, yes. I think they have, like, our older elders have seen one or two elders when they were very young, and the elders were very old, and they weren't very exposed to that, and it was taboo to talk about
interesting, eh?
Tattoos. So for me, it means taking that back, taking back our identity and our womanhood, our place in our Inuit society. These were signs of beauty and strength and skill. So taking that pride back, mm-hmm. That's what it means to me. And to have my daughter to bring this tradition back, mm-hmm. In Nunavik specifically, because there aren't many Nunavik tattoos, not just Nunavik, in the Inuit region, there aren't that many hand poke traditional contemporary tattoo artists today.
Mm-hmm. I get people look at me and I forget why people are staring at me, and then realize, oh, I have chin tattoos.
Yeah.
What response do you get?
Most of the time it's positive.
Okay.
Sometimes, mostly online is where I get negative comments.
Really?
They don't come out and give me negative feedback face to face, but they're very brave online to say negative comments. But I mostly get positive. A lot of questions for sure, especially from non-Inuit and non-Indigenous people. Some are like very curious and they want a deeper answer or a more elaborate answer, and sometimes when I don't feel like it, I just say it just means that I'm an Inuk woman, or when I feel like it, I'll elaborate more. Like for my chin tattoo, for example, I'll explain that girls got this chin line when they got their first menstruation, and this practice was taken away when colonizers came. I obviously didn't get it when I first got my period, because we didn't practice this until the resurgence that we're living now.
Mm-hmm. How do you hold that responsibility in that revitalization of our Inuit culture? Where does that come from for you?
I just live it. I do what I personally want to do. I don't do it for anyone externally. I find it beautiful. I find it, I just love the aesthetic of it and the meaning behind it.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the world globally, we are of a tiny fraction in the world population as Inuit.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to have our own identity, our own markings, our own songs and language and clothing, all these things make us who we are as a people. And to show that, represent that, gives me a sense of pride.
It's so beautiful.
Mm.
I feel that when we're walking and we don't even know the person, but we see their markings,
mm-hmm.
immediately feel a connection. Do you
yes,
feel like that
yeah,
sometimes?
Yeah. And the more, like, more and more we're seeing women, Inuit women with tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
when it was unheard of. Mm-hmm. And I find that the older generation really struggles with that.
Yeah.
They really struggle with it. Like, it really bothers them. Mm-hmm. Some get really mad.
Lateral violence.
Lateral violence is so real in our people, in our communities, which is really too bad. Mm-hmm. It's really too bad because the other day, I got a comment on my Facebook saying, what skills do you have? What Inuit knowledge do you have to have these tattoos? And for many years, I didn't respond. I let all these negative comments slide, tried to anyways. And throughout the years, it just accumulates. Like, being a public
figure
that I am, trying to be, try to keep class and composure and have a respectable image and being careful with what I say, which I've been doing all these years, but it's been too long that I just didn't respond. So now I'm starting to respond, and I try to do it carefully because I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
I'm human. These negative comments do get to me, and I don't know these people, and they don't. These people don't know me, and constantly trying to let it roll off like it's water on a rain jacket is tiring for me. So when someone who doesn't know me comments things like that, like, what knowledge do you have? What basically saying, what right do you have to own these tattoos? First of all, I'm Inuk. I don't need to justify to you to have these markings. That alone makes me eligible, perfect to have these tattoos. Second, I just said, I know a lot. I didn't comment like I'm Inuk. Like in that particular comment, I replied, I know a lot. That's sarcastically.
That's
I know a lot. Like,
you do too. I mean, like you mentioned off the top, you do everything.
It's so sad that our people have been colonized so much that they have taken on the colonizer's voice, because that's the record that they hear in their head. They've been brainwashed so much. How Inuk are you?
Mm-hmm.
How much do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Did you earn these markings?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's beautiful to see Inuit men too getting traditional markings.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're Inuk. That's all you need. Yeah.
True story.
Mm-hmm.
So, having that in mind, how do you see us moving forward as Inuit into reclaiming so many things in our cultures? Obviously, we cannot reclaim everything that we lost as Inuit.
Yeah.
But this is definitely something that we've reclaimed.
Yeah.
Moving forward, how do you see the next generation?
We are so fortunate that we have knowledge keepers that are passionate about teaching. And we have to respect these teachers, record everything. Anthropologists, thankfully, recorded so much. That's how we know a lot about our culture, because of non-Inuit anthropologists who came to our lands and they recorded everything. They recorded as much as they could. And Inuit being an oral history keepers, they didn't have recording devices, they didn't have written material. they pass down knowledge through oral history, and that's like, that was key, and that is still key. In today's world, we have to try and record everything, preserve everything. We have to keep practicing our traditional knowledge, even if we're not certain on how to do certain things. Like, for example, I need to master how to make gamik, sealskin boots, the traditional way. I've done it with a teacher a couple of times, and I'm insecure about it, but if I want to master it, I have to keep doing it. So whatever traditional knowledge that we know a little bit, we have to try and learn more and master it so that we can teach it to our younger ones, so we don't lose it in any of it. Yes, we have lost many things, but we still have a lot, and our elders are passing away, like one by one, just treasure troves of knowledge that they're taking with them to their graves. So we have to spend time with our elders, mm-hmm. learn from them, mm-hmm. not just about traditional knowledge, but about life in general.
And making friends with them. Yeah. They get lonely.
They get
and they
very
just
lonely.
Wait for us to ask questions.
Yeah. And then, like, we wouldn't have any regrets if we spent time with them. Mm-hmm. And, it, like, they just want company too.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be all day. Mm-hmm. Like,
Nakitu elders.
Nakitu elders, Montreal me.
We're looking for grannies in Montreal. If anybody knows of any, we want to visit.
Yeah. Inu Khatikai. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Words and Culture. I can't believe it's my last episode, but it's a very special episode because we are talking about Kakinit and Tunit. These are traditional Inuit tattoos. Once upon a time in Inuit culture, it was said that a woman's face was compared to a liver if her face did not have any tattoos on it. That's how common they were until we were forcefully told that it was evil to do so. So what once was used to beautify a woman's face and body is now being revitalized in our communities as a way to promote pride in our culture. In my interview with singer-songwriter Beatrice Deer, she explains how she even has the thigh tattoos. These are so that when your baby is being born, they are the first beautiful things that they see as they enter the world from the womb. So you see what I mean about how special these markings are? However, revitalization for us Inuit today means that the tattoos have both traditional but perhaps more personal meanings, because each region of Inuit Nunangat and Inuit Nunangat, Inuit country, Inuit lands, is very big. They had different meanings for their kakinit. Here, Beatrice explained that the talodi, or the line tattoo on her chin, marked a young woman's first menstrual experience. For me, however, the line is to mark the child I lost in January. My beautiful daughter Madeline passed away suddenly, and this is how I honored her beautiful life. Arsenic Deer is Beatrice's daughter. We are in the living room at my historic house in Quebec. The irony could not be more explosive because the house is facing Lake St. Louis and it's just so beautiful. There is a lot going on in my house. Bannock is being made in the kitchen, and a very cute and curious little 8-year-old with cerebral palsy is racing around asking all kinds of questions as I lay on my green couch, my feet hanging on the back of the couch, and Arsenic is wearing her headlamp on her forehead with my head on her lap, and her ink and her handmade tools for traditional tattooing are right beside her. You know what though? It really feels like home here today, considering how far I am from home and considering all of the chatter. It feels at peace in my home today. Thank you for being here with me. As Arsenik tells me, she had wanted to help me remember my daughter by giving me my markings in honor of her life lived. My baby was just a couple of years older than Arsenik. What made you want to become a traditional hand poker tattooist?
I didn't know I wanted to be one. It was unexpected. Huvak Johnston came to Montreal to do tattoos for Nunavik Sivunitsavut students. And my mom and I got an appointment with her outside of the school. So I got my temples done, my first face tattoos done by her, 4 days after my 20th birthday. She was gonna tattoo my mom's thighs the next day with Evie recording, like filming it.
Okay.
Evie Mark.
Yeah.
Huvak asked if I wanted to come and watch, so I went to my mom's. It was kind of already late at night, and they already started her thighs. I think they finished, they were done with one thigh by the time I got there. And then when she was starting the other thigh, I watched her like prepare for it. And I was sitting beside her, my mom was on the table, Evie was filming. And Huvak asked if I wanted to try. So immediately I wanted to and was excited and nervous at the same time.
Did you poke your own mother?
Yeah,
she was
my first time.
Wow. Did it hurt, Mom?
Yeah.
Sorry. Keep going.
Huvak told me to poke harder because I wasn't poking hard enough.
Okay.
So I did one line on her thigh.
On your mom's thigh?
Very first one.
Wow.
And then Huvak continued the rest and finished that side. It was probably like midnight or almost midnight when she was done. So she cleaned up, and then Huvak said, I'll show you how I set up so you know how I do this, like how I set up and prepare. So I was like, okay. So I watched her, and she showed me how. And she showed me how to make the needle for the tattoo. And I asked her, like, why are you wasting a needle? You're not tattooing anymore. And then she said, you're gonna tattoo me. So I got really nervous.
I just got goosebumps. Wow.
I was so nervous.
Hi, Daddy.
Hi.
I didn't expect it. So I did one line on her wrist, because she has a few lines on her wrist where her students or those people she taught had a tattoo, did a line on her. So I did one on her. And after we were done, we cleaned up, and she told me to get like a container for all of her stuff to put in. And after I helped her clean up, I gave her the container, and she said, that's your starter kit. So I got to keep like the rest of her supplies, because she had to go back to Nova Scotia. She was living there at the time. She left the next day, and I started practicing on my best friends. They let me practice on them, but they were really nice. Like, they don't look like first
beginner.
Yeah.
Because your mom did say that you are already an artist.
Yeah.
So this came naturally to you?
Sort of, yeah. But I had to learn a lot more than I did that night.
And so fast forward, how many traditional tattoos have you done, you think?
Maybe.
Did you lose track?
I lost track, but I'm guessing maybe 200.
Already?
In almost 5 years. It's going to be 5 years in November.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you do know that this is a huge part of our revitalization, of our part of our culture that was lost.
I learned that when I was studying at Nunavik Sivunitsavu.
Yeah.
I didn't know that before. Evie was my teacher at the time, and she taught us like everything, what our people went through, about the markings and colonization. That's when I was 19. And before that, I didn't really know anything about our culture or traditions, and I was very unaware. And I didn't like my culture. I didn't like being Inuk before I learned that colonization and what our people went through, what our grandparents went through. Mm-hmm. Before that, I didn't want to be Inuk.
Really?
Until I learned, and I learned about the markings. Because before I knew, I was very like ignorant and unaware. I would say things like, I would never get a tattoo on the face. Like, it doesn't look good. But only when I learned, I started to find our culture and traditions and markings so beautiful, and I wanted it to be part of my life.
Who did your facial tattoos?
After I got my temples done, mm-hmm. Zor Gahauna from Iklalik, she did the two lines here on my chin. Mm-hmm. And after I added the dots on my chin, that was like a couple years later when I was brave enough to add the dots on my chin on myself, mm-hmm. with a mirror. And then I did my forehead.
By yourself?
With a mirror, yeah.
Wow.
And then I did like my temples, mm-hmm. above Hovak's, like above the ones Hovak did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so now that you've tattooed so many Inuit women, almost over probably 200 in the last 5 years, how does it make you feel now when you walk around and see all the markings you have provided? Women who would have not otherwise, because you're traveling all over the north, eh?
Yeah, it feels unreal. Mm-hmm. I still can't believe it sometimes, and I have the same feeling that I have every time after I finish a tattoo. I feel so much pride and joy and love for that person, because with this work, it's pretty often that so many of our women go through heavy things, and they feel comfortable to share with me, and it's always healing for her, and I just feel so much love every time, and it really, sometimes I get so emotional, out of love and joy.
Oh my God, for one thing, I've never done an interview upside down like this, laying on my head. But you have your headlamp on, and you've just given me my lines on my chin, right in the middle of the dots that Hovak blessed me with, my very first chin tattoos. I want to say thank you, Nakomipagit, Inwe Pekosivini to Halunganing, Tunisigunda to Kuhatta. And the reveal begins. Wow, taka to see Vunga, to see my new chin tattoo. Wow, it looks complete now. It looks complete. I love it. Nakumi. All right. Well, to our listeners, I really look beautiful now. Nakomi. Yay.
Well, thank you all for coming along this journey with me. Like I said at the beginning, there was a time when we were not allowed to have our traditional tattoos, and we almost lost this part of our very beautiful culture. Today, I could not imagine I would be able to share this experience with you on the radio, but I did, and I thank you for joining me. As our time on Words and Culture draws to a close, I want to share a final word with you. The word is Nakormik. 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 Thank you to all of our guests. Nakormik.